The recent decision of the Supreme Court in the Sabarimala case was controversial as soon as it was laid down. We've seen protests not just at the shrine but also at different parts of Kerala. And we've also seen deep divisions amongst legal commentators and journalists alike in the print media. What a lot of people don't know is that just as the Supreme Court was laying down its decision in that case, the Bombay High Court was hearing a petition by persons of Zoroastrian faith on the right to religious freedom under the constitution. It was a petition filed by certain persons of the Zoroastrian faith who objected to the metro passing under their fire temple on the ground that the connection between the sacred fire and the core of the earth was broken by the passing of the metro. The counsel who argued that case on behalf of the Zoroastrian petitioners was Navroz Sirwai, and we are fortunate today because we have him with us today to discuss the Sabarimala judgment and religious freedom under the Indian constitution generally. Navroz, thanks a lot for being here with us.
You're welcome.
Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, there was a deep division in the Supreme Court as well over this particular issue. Now, different judges decided differently and there was even one dissent. My first question is, do you think the majority was correct or do you agree with the dissent? Do you think the Supreme Court decided the case correctly?
I think, broadly speaking, the majority judgment is correct, though the minority, if I may say so, is highly persuasive. But giving it a lot of thought, at the end of the day, I do feel that it is the majority judgment that is correct and is, in this vexed subject, the correct way forward.
Okay. Now, in the dissent, Justice Malhotra seemed to think that the petitioners before her, who in this case were the Indian Young Lawyers Association, failed to show that they had adequate locus standi because they themselves did not claim to be devotees. Her viewpoint seemed to be that if you aren't even a devotee of this particular idol, then what right do you have to approach the Supreme Court in a petition? Do you think that the petition was rightly entertained?
Aditya, again, this is a difficult question and there are no easy answers. At first blush, especially, Justice Malhotra says sounds reasonable, sounds logical, and therefore attractive. But having given it a lot of thought, having read the judgments not once but several times, at the end of the day, again, I do feel that the scales tilt in favor of the majority judges who entertained the petition and rejected the argument of standing and locus standi.
All right. And at the soul of this judgment are two different, very different views of looking at the constitution, I feel. Firstly, the majority seems to look at the issue from the perspective that the constitution protects and subserves a just and equitable order and has a social revolutionary intent. It is disruptive and transformative in its nature, and if something comes in the way of that just order, then that bar has to be removed. On the other hand, the dissent looks at it differently. Justice Malhotra seems to think that the constitution protects religious pluralism, and if you're going to look at religious rights from the microscope of rationality, then those rights may cease to exist. I'm not asking you about the correctness of the judgment because you already answered that, but do you think these two ways of looking at the constitution are irreconcilable, and if so, which view do you agree with?
Let me start by saying that I myself argued that if there is one area where logic, reason and rationality has virtually no part to play, it is in the field of religion. It's almost axiomatic that religion is founded on faith and belief, It may be irrational. In fact, some of the earlier judgments go to the extent of saying that outsiders may think that it is absurd or ridiculous. They may think that it is superstition and not genuinely religious belief or faith. But not for nothing did Justice Mukherjee, in the first two seminal cases in 1954, propound the doctrine that fundamentally, in the first place, the court will be guided with the views of the persons who adhere to and believe in that religion, who are the followers of that religion. If one looks at it from that perspective, despite what I just said about the correctness of the judgment, one would be inclined to accept Justice Malhotra's viewpoint that not only does the Constitution protect religious pluralism, it gives a very high status to these fundamental rights under 25 to 28, in particular 25 and 26. And that really to try and examine these practices and beliefs and tenets, be it under 25 or 26, from the point of view of reason, logic, rationality, is antithetical to what the framers of the Constitution actually intended. On the other hand, I don't think it's irreconcilable, the majority view and the minority view, because the majority has, whilst repeating and reiterating the importance of these fundamental rights in India, especially in India, they have rather carefully, and I must say for once, realizing the gravity of the matter, not sweepingly and broadly, but with a certain degree of specificity, carved out the area where they feel that other rights under the Path 3, our fundamental rights, would prevail or trump the right under 25 or 26. And they seem to draw the line where the assertion of the right under 25 would blatant, or 25 and 26, would blatantly violate other important, very important fundamental rights under 14, 19 and 21. Qua the followers of that very religion. So for example, all three majority judgments say that given that 25 is an individual right and not a denominational right, each individual has a right, and you are denying both the religious right under 25 itself, not to mention violating 14 and 21 to Hindu women. And that surely could not be the intent and purpose of 25 and the framers of the Constitution. So I would say that if future courts, future benches adhere to this line, sort of a Lakshman Rekha, which of course in each case may not be as simple to, in fact not simple at all to gauge on which side you fall. But if that's a task the court would have to do, but if they could, then I think you could have a synthesis on the one hand, rejecting a possible extreme stand which the minority takes, that we just won't interfere with it, and the stand of the majority, that by and large we accept the earlier judgments, the later judgments, the importance of this fundamental right, but we won't allow it to damage or affect the general social fabric which is to be found in 14, 19 and 21. So that, I think, would be my answer.
Right. And just to add to that, of course, the right under Article 25 is expressly made subject to...
To the remaining... Yes, to the other fundamental rights in Part 3.
Right. And now, one more question about this requirement about showing the court that the practice that you're seeking protection of is an essential religious practice. This is judge-made law. You won't find the words essential religious practice in the Constitution. Justice Chandrachud, especially in his judgment, has taken the view that this essential religious practices test makes judges into theologians. It makes them go through scriptures and religious tenets to find out if a religious practice is essential. And in fact, we need to replace this with a test which accepts at face value that what the religious group is saying is an essential religious practice, and then see how the chips fall and decide if it is a right protected under Articles 25 and 26. What is your viewpoint? What do you think?
I think Justice Chandrachud is correct. In fact, if I may say so, that part of his judgment is one of the most intellectually rigorous and one of the most jurisprudential parts of his judgment. He has highlighted the fundamental contradiction at the heart of the Constitution itself. Even as he has in other parts of his judgment asserted that 25 and 26 will have to, 25, sorry, in particular, will have to be subservient, in a sense subservient, or give way in certain circumstances to 14, 19 and 21. Mm. How the theory evolved would be an essay or a book in itself, and we won't get into that. In fact, he goes to the extent of saying we sit as a constitutional court and not an ecclesiastical court.
Correct.
And we are neither equipped in terms of expertise, nor, he suggests, nor were meant by the framers, or if you just look at the articles, to dive, to sort of wade into these theological and ecclesiastical questions. I think that part of his judgment, I mean his entire judgment, but certainly that part, which is part F, he's done it from A to K, bears very, very close scrutiny and consideration. And yes, I think he certainly raised a legal and constitutional issue that requires very close and careful consideration. Of course, the $100 million question is that what would replace it? I'm not 100%. I'm not sure, Aditya, that he's gone to the extent of saying that we should just leave it to the followers of that religion. He sort of at the end of that part says that it needs to be re-looked at.
But what
would replace it is not something that he has in so many words enunciated. He said that it will have to be considered in a future case.
Sticking to the judgment of Justice Chandrachud, in his judgment he does something which according to me is quite bold. Article 17 of the Constitution, which deals with the abolition of untouchability, has in the last few years, as these restrictions are less and less prevalent in our society, been more or less dormant. He has revitalized the article in this case by saying that the exclusion of women of menstrual age, which was the usage in the Sabarimala temple, offends that particular article, which deals with the abolition of untouchability. The dissent counters this by saying that no, Article 17 was only to deal with caste-based exclusion. I'm going to put you on the spot. What viewpoint do you agree?
I must say that this one is an easier question to answer than some of the others. And this is one area where I think, with utmost respect to Justice Chandrachud, I think he's gone completely wrong. I thought that on my first reading, I thought that on my second reading, and I thought that on my third reading. I think on this issue, Justice Malhotra is absolutely correct. She uses very cogent reasoning. She quotes very cogent sources. And she uses, and all kudos to her, given that she had just gone onto the bench and in a minority judgment, she uses quite strong language in differing from Justice Chandrachud's viewpoint. I agree with her. I think Justice Chandrachud on this is wrong. But, I don't change my view, but I noticed on one of my three readings that Justice Nariman, in a footnote in his judgment, makes reference to the minority judgment of Chief Justice B.P. Sinha in the Syedna case.
Right.
And draws attention of people, lawyers and lay people alike, to the fact that in his minority judgment,
page 149,
he makes note of the fact that Justice Sinha considered excommunication as a form of untouchability.
Right.
Obviously, the majority and the concurring judgment, Dasgupta and Rajagopal Iyengar, rejected that. Interestingly, Justice Nariman himself does not necessarily adhere to that view or deal with it. It is only Justice Chandrachud and Justice Malhotra who deal with it. I think that adequately answers it. My even despite having noted this minority view of Justice Chief Justice B.P. Sinha, commented on by Justice Nariman, I think my answer has to be very firmly in favor of the view of Justice Malhotra and against that propounded by Justice Chandrachud.
Now, both of us have read this judgment, but that's because we're lawyers. It's 411 pages long. It's harder and harder now to read the long judgments that spew forth from the Honorable Supreme Court. In this case itself, four honorable judges issued judgments, all formidable long judgments. Now, if you had to recommend one of these judgments to students or to laymen,
I'm not able to answer that question in a simple way of A or B or C. And it's not that I'm ducking the question. I would answer it this way, and you'll have to take it as it is. I would say that the student who was interested in knowing the law on 25 and 26 and not necessarily want to get into larger, more jurisprudential, I would even say more philosophic issues, I would unhesitatingly recommend Justice Nariman's judgment, because it's an amazing, as all his judgments are, an amazing review. The word recap is would be doing injustice, a review, in-depth review of the entire case law. In fact, it is not a coincidence, you see this in many of his judgments, that whilst many other concurring judges refer to the standard ones, about 10-20, you find in Justice Nariman's judgments a reference to at least 5 or 10 judgments, which even the other judges haven't referred to, etc. And for, if nothing else, then for that reason, I would recommend Justice Nariman's judgment. If on the other hand, you have a law student or a layperson who wants to look at it not just, I mean, of course, in the legal concept context, but not just in the legal concept context, but a much broader, wider discussion, a philosophic and jurisprudential discussion, and of course the law on 25 and 26, I would be inclined, of course, then to recommend Justice Chandrachud's judgment. So that's how I would answer this one.
Now, you've already indicated that you agree with the majority judgment.
But if
the persons who disagree with this judgment and who want to see it set aside were to come to you as for legal advice on how it could be reversed, as a lawyer, you have to give them advice. It's your duty. How would you advise them?
Difficult. It would be difficult. One obvious piece of advice that one could give as a lawyer is for them to try and persuade Parliament in its constituent capacity and character to amend the Constitution, to make it very clear that the courts can't go into this. In short, in some way or the other, to say in statutory or constitutional language and not legal language what Justice Malhotra has said. The other could be to persuade the legislature in Kerala to amend the act and to declare that it is a denomination. The followers of Lord Ayyappa do constitute a denomination. That would take you out of 25 and having to stand the test of the other fundamental rights. It would take you into 26, which is a denomination. And then it's always easier to accept a denominational practice than it is if you're dealing not with a denomination within a religion, but the religion as a whole. Because the chances of there then being conflicts are much more. That could be the second.
Now, we've delved quite deeply into the law on this subject, and thanks in no small part to your great insight on the issue. Now, let me ask you a more general question. The passing of this judgment was in a sense a perfect storm, because it also coincided with this upsurge in the form of the Me Too movement in the print and social media, where women were rightly objecting to their horrific treatment at the workplace. Justice Indu Malhotra recently in a speech said that there's rampant sexism in the profession, and we see it from the underrepresentation of women both in the judiciary and in the profession generally. How do you think that this problem of sexism in our profession can be tackled?
Not easy at all. One would be dealing with tradition and practice which one could say almost has reached the level of gestalt, the gestalt of individuals. And of course, when I say individuals, I mean men. But because it isn't easy, doesn't mean one doesn't do it or doesn't propound a change. So whilst we know where we are starting from, I think two fundamental points I'd like to make. One is that at the end of the day, it needs a fundamental change in the attitude and perception, both intellectual and emotional, which I think is very important, but not to be misunderstood, of men towards how they perceive women in the workplace. And according to me, if that doesn't change, you're not going to be able to change anything. The other is those who have it in their power, and I would say that in that situation it would mean certainly judges across the bar, from the Supreme Court down to your district courts, magistrates courts, tribunals, etc. Not just the Supreme Court and High Court, High Courts. Realizing this and being much more sensitive to it and proactive. And that also could percolate to, I mean, I'm now restricting it to the system I know, which is of seniors, of large solicitors' firms. In the case of seniors, actively taking young ladies into their chamber as juniors, for example. In the case of solicitors' firms or advocates' firms, the partners, the people who own the firm, or essentially, therefore, the partners, making women partners, again encouraging and taking young ladies in as associates, and in their case ensuring that there is no harassment in the workplace. So I think it's a combination of all. So if the judges do it, if the council who take on juniors are aware of it and encourage young ladies by taking them on in their chambers, if law firms do it, you may see some change. Okay. That's how I see it.
Okay. Navroz, thanks a lot for this illuminating and riveting discussion.
Welcome.